Welcome to Fear the Boot bonus episode. I don't even know what.
Something crazy.
Yeah, I'd look it up. Yeah, I think this is 7 or 8. I'd look it up.
I think we're at 8 now.
Are we? But this was a high quality, you know, regular episode. I'd go look it up. But for a bonus episode, we don't really worry about it.
So now, what's the real reason why we're doing this bonus episode? We might as well come clean, right?
All right, we're going to come clean. Now, normally, what we do when we record these episodes is
The bonus episode.
We record a regular episode. We used to record them at noon on Saturdays. But now Chad's work schedule's changed, mm-hmm. so we record these at about 5 o'clock or so on Saturdays. And what we do is if we had, you know, we finished a regular episode, and we were raring to go on another subject that wasn't related to the show, mm-hmm. and we had some extra time, we would sit down and do a bonus episode, just to work off that energy in some productive way. But today, we sat down to do the regular episode.
And it was like... We got, what, 10, 15 minutes into it, and we were just kind of looking at each other like, wow, this is a snore fest.
Yeah, this just wasn't working. It was
total crap.
So now we scrapped it, and we have not yet recorded a regular episode for this coming Monday
or
Tuesday.
Who knows if we will?
Well, I know we will.
We better record one. I'm not coming back tomorrow.
So we decided what we're going to do instead is we... got rid of the Snorefest we'd recorded, just deleted it. Mm-hmm. And we decided instead we're going to record a bonus episode first just to get us all jazzed up, all in a... What are you even...
Look at your cat.
This is why cats don't ever have to leave home.
Basically, Dan's cat's pulling a Ron Jeremy, and I'll leave it at that. Oh, by the way, did we say that these bonus episodes are completely unedited?
Yeah, if this is your first time listening to Fear the Boot, these shows are neither edited, organized, quality controlled. None of these things occur here. So we decided, getting back a little bit on subject here, that we were going to do a bonus episode to get us all jazzed up and all aflutter, and then we were going to go back and record a regular episode. And the topic... Do I need to move the cat?
That's outrageous. I'm sorry, I'm just not a cat owner. That's something I don't see every day.
It's blinding.
All right, for those of you who still can't get what we're
talking
about.
Thank you, Maverick.
Cats are extremely flexible and capable of cleaning any square inch of their body.
Any square inch of their body,
and he was just demonstrating that ability for Chad.
He was displaying it. He was giving me a tutorial on how to do it. Ugh. Have you no pride, cat?
Anyway. Lots of pride.
No, lions have pride. What do you do call a group of house cats? You know, like a bunch of crows is a murder and a bunch of lions is a pride.
You call them a sneeze or something.
Sneeze?
I don't think so.
Huh.
I'm pretty sure.
You can find whole, like, there's like emails that float around that, like pages upon pages of what you call groups of things. Mm-hmm. And some of them are kind of strange.
Adam and I called, people, like groups of people didn't have a name, or I'm sure they did and we just didn't know it. We called them a violence of humans.
Didn't you call a group of gamers a rank of gamers?
A rank of gamers. Yes. That was after a Archon.
Usually a bunch of gamers are on that kind of rank.
Yeah, it was a 3-day con, or it was 3 days into a con, and some of these gamers had been going 3 days solid. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. So, before digging into negative gamer stereotypes too much, what we're going to record this show about is a couple bonus episodes ago, we recorded a BattleTech gush.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's not much of a mystery that across the hosts, in our opinions, contrary to popular belief, are not even vaguely all the same, but we're kind of like a Venn diagram. And one of those places where all of our circles overlap is BattleTech.
Yes.
That we all... Mm-hmm. BattleTech's a game we really like. For me, it's not my number one. It's definitely in my top three. It's not my number
one. BattleTech is not your number one?
No. BattleTech is not my number one.
What?
It's probably my number two. It's not my number one.
What?
Oh, yeah. My God.
All these years, I thought
disturbing.
I knew you.
Disturbing.
But here's the point. BattleTech, for all of us, is in our top number one or number two or maybe number three at worst. So... we did that episode about all the things we loved about BattleTech and why we loved BattleTech. Eyes here, Chad. Eyes here.
I was just so amazed.
The cat's not doing anything.
Someone was at number three. That's what was amazing. Who's at who puts BattleTech at number three? I know this person.
Melina doesn't like it at all.
She likes zombie games.
Yeah.
Well, see, she said, though, that part of the reason she doesn't like Battletech is apparently she had some game of it with you where you scarred her in some way. I don't know. I have no idea which.
He forced her to play. That's what he did. Oops.
And she doesn't listen to these.
But forcing someone to play Battletech's like being raped by a Swedish blonde. I mean.
Interesting analogy.
But I know she said something about the game where she kept getting her mech shot out from under her. I don't know.
Oh, that's not my fault.
All right. Well, anyhow.
I just roll the dice. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. So coming back around. Yeah, we definitely needed this to work some things out.
Yes.
So we were going to talk about, kind of juxtapose our Battletech gush, and we were going to talk about what it is that eventually put us off about Battletech. Because now, exactly where this occurred for each of us is a little bit different, but there's kind of this shade of gray between the year 3050 and 3060 in the game continuum, where every one of us, one by one, fell off the bandwagon and kind of lost our taste for the game. Lost our taste for where they were taking the game, not the game as a whole. Still love Battletech, still own it, still play it. But we lost our taste for it as a whole. So let's talk about what happened, what went wrong, why we did not like where they took the game. And I think, and I know FASA went through some lawsuits and they had some internal problems, but I think this is one of the things that ultimately took them down as a company, kept the bottom line from being decent enough to support all the other problems they were having. Yeah, now the cat's trying to knock over the tray that Dawn's mic is on, which also happens to have a...
Your pervert cat is so disruptive, Dan.
He is. Well, now he's over there in the dog food dishes.
How much does he weigh? Like 5 pounds? How can 5 pounds cause that much trouble?
If you're a big enough pervert, I guess.
Dawn, wait until your baby's born. That's all I gotta say. Wait until your baby's born. And
true.
Let's say, you know, first couple years, you will find out just how much trouble a handful of pounds can cause.
I know. I think I'm just blocking the whole thing out of my mind until it actually happens.
All right, Chad, let's start with you. You were probably the first one to fall off the bandwagon. What was the first source book that really significantly bothered you in terms of gamer?
I wish we had video.
I know. I wish this was a video podcast now.
That pervert cat is now attacking Dan. Dan's sitting here in a chair talking, and all of a sudden the cat jumped up on its lap and was basically trying to claw the headphones off.
What he does, he's got this neurosis where he's not comfortable in a lap. And I'm serious, he wants to be up on your shoulder. So he's trying to climb up on my shoulder to sit.
But I thought he was trying to molest there. You.
No, he won't.
Fear the cat. Anyway. No, when the clans very first... Well, it was the clans. That's pretty much what killed it for me. When the clans, pardon me, when the clans...
Well, hold on 1 second. Because there was something that came before the clans that it was my understanding you also had a problem with, which was the revival of Lost Tech, or the return of Star League technology.
No, I liked Star League technology, and I'll tell you why in a second.
Okay.
It was the clans that...
All right, so I guess I misunderstood your position then.
It was the technology of the clans that I really hated. The Star League technology that they introduced was, I said that 15 years ago as a kid, but looking back on it and thinking back on it as an adult, I think that adding in Star League technology, basically for people who don't play Battletech, it's lasers that shoot a little bit further, do a little bit more damage, missiles that do a little bit more damage, some different little devices that help you in different ways on the battlefield. But it was just small upgrades and small changes. I think that was a good idea to keep the game from getting stale. Well, see,
and I
these were also it was also still rare.
Well, you know? And even if it was common, even if it was super common and on every mech, it did not bother me for really two big reasons. One, it did not specifically change the feel of the game.
Right.
And we'll talk about how Clantech did and kind of draw the line there, why I don't think it changed the feel of the game. Well, I guess it wasn't modular, it wasn't cheap and common. Mm-hmm. But secondly, it was also balanced. You know, that ERPPC had a whole lot more range and no minimum range, but also generated 50% more heat.
Yeah, and heat is a big factor.
And that heat sink may have that, you know, put off or let out twice the amount of heat, mm-hmm. but it took up a huge number of critical slots. You paid a heavy price right. for everything you put on that mech, and if you wanted the better technology to perform better, sure, you got it, but you also had to pay some kind of a price to get that right. on your mech.
Right.
So that's why it didn't bother me
now,
really
here's
at
my
all.
Problem with BattleTech. What killed it for me is that the clans came in around the same time, and I have a laundry list of problems with the clans, their story, the background, that sort of thing. But really what my problem was that just cinched it was the fact that they turned mechs into Lego mechs. Now, what I mean by that is that a battle mech is, in the game, something that is passed down from generation to generation, a single battle mech. It's this device of war that has a history behind it. It's been around for 100, 200 years, maybe even sometimes longer, that your grandfather's grandfather captured it from someone else's great-grandfather who had it in their family lineage for all these years. And it was a sign of nobility, and it was like the steed that the knight rode in on. Well, when the clans rode in, their technology was just superior. Everything about the clans was superior. Their technology was superior. Their tactics were superior. Their weapons were superior. Their everything was superior.
Yeah, even down to literally in the books, they were even better looking.
Yeah. They were better looking, and people liked them better. And they it's just like, oh, shut up. Stop masturbating, you know? It's just, give me a better story instead of just better, 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 better. And anyway, since they had all the mechs and they had all the technology, they had this modular design where you can like press a button and pop one of the weapons off and then put another weapon in its place. Had these pods. Intersphere mechs didn't have that. Basically, you got what you got, and it was a matter of having to work around things. Right. Mechs had disadvantages. They got too hot, or they didn't have long range, or they didn't have short range. And there were, it was a matter of you had to work around the problem. And your mech wasn't 100% advantages.
Let me comment a little bit on what you said, and then let me kind of offer sort of a categorical problem that I think BattleTech fell to, that I think a lot of games have fallen to. To respond real quick, I agree with you that BattleTech was all about resourcefulness. It was about scarcity. It was about a kind of noble attachment to your mech that was your family crest. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were not tanks. This was not something you hopped in and drove around to kill things. It represented something above and beyond that. You didn't just change them out.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were so scarce that you worked with what you had. You couldn't just... You wanted mechs that had long-range missiles, but all you had was a bunch of close-range brawlers, and you had to make it work. Now, what I think BattleTech fell prey to is really twofold, but I'll come back to the other point a little bit later. The one I want to hit here, because I think this happens to a lot of games, is a cycle of escalation. That rather than moving the story forward, they move the story up. Now, Magic is a big example of this. With Magic the card game, I played a couple games of it, owned some starter decks, thought it was interesting, never got really into it. The reason I didn't is because every time they released a new expansion, there were cards in there that were more powerful than anything in the previous expansions. And it had to be that way, because otherwise you wouldn't buy it.
Right.
And the end result was, he who had the most recent cards wins. And I realize somebody's probably write me in and say, well, I was at a convention, the guy that was dominating everybody was a guy with things from the first edition. And I realize, well, you know,
good for him.
Yeah, good for him.
But that wasn't it for the average player.
Right, but that's not what was generally going on. And BattleTech did the same thing. That they had the 3025 mechs, and they had a lot of neat plot. And as they advanced the game, rather than just releasing more things or different things, they escalated. That with every source book, and this got really bad from 3050 on, things got more powerful with every book.
Right.
And if you took a mech out of the 3050 book versus a mech taken out later on down the line when they had proto-mechs and neural tattoos and all these ridiculous things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you couldn't compete. And
see,
I know
that was another thing they did, too. They got to a point to where they just couldn't make things more powerful. So they started making things weird. Instead of having, you know, small light mechs, they had, like, super light exoskeletons. And then they had in-between mechs. And then they had, it's like, all these different shades of gray between their lightest mech and their ground troop. And it was just like, who cares? You know, it's cheesy.
Well, and I think part of what also happened there, and I don't know, and I'm going to admit right now, I do not know the intimate decisions that were being you know, made down at FASO with Brian Nystuhl and so on and so forth. So I don't have any insight into that. I did used to write for their fan magazine, but that's as close as I ever got to them. I knew the guys at AWOL Productions really well. I did not know the guys at FASO. But what it seemed like to me, and to my group of friends, Chad included at the time, and Dawn included at the time, was that, you know, there came a point where they were not growing Battletech the way they wanted to. Their RPG market had relatively stagnated. And that's a, we have our thoughts on that, but that's a bigger subject for another time. But what they started doing was they started trying to kind of re-envision the game. And they did it partially through escalation, but I think they also did it by trying to broaden the market of appeal. That Battletech had always been a favorite game of your, I mean, really, your college, your 20-somethings, because it was really a thinking man's game. It was not a, ooh, I make Phytor the Barbarian. And so it was, it's a more of
good
a...
Good old Phytor.
And no, I'm not dissing D&D. I'm just dissing a stereotype. But it's, it, you know, it's more of a thinking person's game. And what they ended up doing was they started making it all kiddied. They went through it. And they started putting out trading cards. And then they came out with this ridiculous cartoon. And the cartoon had a bunch of toys from Gloob that supported it.
And so, they were really ugly toys.
Yeah, and none of these things were faithful to the original intention of Battletech.
And so the creators of Battletech were like, oh, well, we got these this cheesy-ass cartoon, and we got these silly toys. Well, we need to draw these people. We need to cross-market this. And so we're going to change the game.
So they wrote it into the canon of Battletech.
And it was just like, what do you do? Imagine the worst possible fanfic getting put in to your favorite series.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Awful.
And
now, let's not get mean.
Don't even get me started on published fanfic. I hate it.
There's some pretty good.
No, there's none.
Jane Austen and Conan Doyle. Ripoffs?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And of course, you know, the end result of all of this was you've now brought in, I mean, a fair amount of cash from younger players, which I've got nothing against bringing younger folks into the game, but here's the problem. When you create a fad for 13-year-olds, it's going to be huge today and gone tomorrow.
Right.
They're going to turn it over in no time. And you bring in the 20-somethings, it may not be a huge growing market, and you may be seeing stagnating sales and da-da-da-da-da, but they're faithful fans.
They seem to have been able to support the product for 20 years, but then again, I wasn't really into the business,
so I don't know. Maybe it wasn't happening, but...
But if you're around for 20 years, you think you're selling a few products.
The 13-year-olds got out of it, moved on to another fad, and by then they had sold...
Or they just they kept playing it, but they played they did what we did. They played the old stuff, and they didn't buy any of the new stuff because the new stuff was awful.
Well, yeah, and then that's kind of what... Then you look at the other side of the equation. Mm-hmm. The people did not get into it through that. I mean, the people got into it as a fad got out of it. The people who had always been there were so alienated at that point, they had no interest in it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's my understanding, the whole thing has now fallen under... it's my understanding Stackpole. Mike Stackpole is now the head... creative director of all of the direction of Battletech.
And who owns it now?
It's under WizKids. Yeah. WizKids. And I don't think he actually owns the product line. I think Jordan Weissman's kid or something like that owns it. I don't know. One of the things,
if you look on Wikipedia, they actually have who owns the copyrights.
If you listen to this podcast, one of the things that you will quickly find out is that we play a lot of games. We know a lot about the games. We don't keep up with the industry, really. I mean, we watch the trends and such, but someone even commented on our show that, you know, said, hey, these guys have a lot of interesting insight, but these are not guys that could tell you who, and he rattled off a bunch of names that I can't tell you who they were.
He rattled off a whole bunch of names I had never heard of before, and then he rattled off a whole bunch of gaming theories and stuff and acronyms, and I was like, eh? Obviously, you don't keep... Well, he didn't say this, but I mean, it was pretty much like, you don't keep up on RPGNet and all this. And I'm like, yeah, I don't. I'm too busy gaming.
Yeah.
Gaming and working.
So, I guess, where's Stackpole's taking it now? I think he fixed some problems because he rebrought about the scarcity of mechs and such, but it just struck me that the game still just has too immature of a feel. I mean,
to be honest,
when its
I
most
have
recent
no idea.
Incarnation is a bunch of is a click game.
Yeah.
I mean, come
other
on.
Other than the clicking, I have no idea what WizKids is doing with Battletech. I don't care. It was basically
it was so trashed.
I have no interest.
Well, I agree with it.
We did buy the map reprints.
Well, that's different.
That's Fan Pro.
Fan Pro is different. Fan Pro is taking care of the stuff that I had wished had happened.
It's my understanding Fan Pro also is advancing the old storyline, mm-hmm. starting like 3070. What I really wish would have happened if
Fan Pro is doing a great job, by the way.
Well, they are, but
I
here's
just have to say that
the series is damaged goods at this point. Yeah. What I would love to see happen is someone handed me a magic wand where I could grant myself the ability to become a published RPG writer writing one thing. What I would love to do is take Battletech back to about 3030 mm-hmm. and take the storyline in a completely different direction.
Well, how do you feel about, like, well, I mean, obviously you feel good about, like, rolling a story back like that?
Normally, I'm not in favor of it, but I think with Battletech, you have a series that started off so well mm-hmm. that ended so poorly. That it just seems almost worth it to me just to pretend that other stuff never happened. Go back to 3030.
I wonder how the fans
shovel out the plan.
Can you ask me why I write fan fiction?
Yeah.
And see, well, that's why I don't. Well, no, that's why I don't diss your fan fiction.
No, I don't diss it at all.
I think sometimes. I mean, I realize some fan fiction is.
I like making fun of fan fiction in general because I think I'm funny, but. That's not, that's about.
It's like, this is how it should have happened, you know?
And I think, you know, there is something to be said for that.
Yeah. I've read countless stories where I've, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to scratch that out. Well, I'm just going to start over.
I think every person out there has the view, and mm-hmm. this may be pompous, this may be accurate, that they could have done it better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I think it cuts both ways, and probably even myself.
I wonder how the creators feel about that. Like say, you know, from fanfic or even Battletech, like, the people who made Battletech, you know, of course there's Battletech fic out there, and then there's people who change the canon and whatnot. I wonder how they feel looking at it now, looking at how it's been changed, or how fans have even changed it in the directions they take it.
Well, and you know, with Battletech, one of the reasons I think this is a case where I'm not just being pompous, I think I could have done it better, is because I talked to a huge number of fans mm-hmm. that we even, you know, were not directly tied to us, who had very, very similar visions for it, that this right. is kind of where they felt it should have gone. You know, kind of taking a sideline to what you just said, I think one of the places where these series all start to fall apart, and you can say it's about movies, role-playing games, whatever, is once they start to really succeed. Mm-hmm. And the reason that is, at least in my mind, is you have this trend. The vast majority of people out there, I would say 99.99999%, so everybody outside of that one exception, someone's going to email me, nobody can write a good story in a vacuum.
Yeah.
The fact is, there may be people out there that are good writers, that have good
ideas. It's the Indiana Jones syndrome.
But you need someone to come along and say, you know what? This is great. This is crap.
Yeah.
Or your story would be better if you did this with it instead. But you get these people or stories that are so big, they lose sight of what it is that made it great in the first place. Yeah. George Lucas is a perfect example.
I give my
you could also be on my point of view that George Lucas was never a good writer. He just had a lot of people backing him.
Yeah. Well, here's my
Indiana. If you read his prose, it's god awful.
Here's my Indiana Jones theory. The first movie was wonderful, and it was because it was a new project, and now I don't know if this is fact. This is just all my theory and my analogy, is that it was a new project, and they went in there to make it, and they're like, they had all these handlers. They had all these producers and studio heads saying, okay, it's got to be like this. It's like, okay, we have this idea. And it's like, no, we don't want you doing that idea. Why don't you take that out? It's like, well, I have this idea. Okay, yeah, do this idea. And, you know, they had all these different inputs in it. And then it was hugely successful. Well, then they go and make the second movie. The second movie's awful. The second movie's awful because when they went to make it, they're like, well, see, we made this smash hit. We made this great movie. Now we have all this creative freedom. We want you guys to leave us alone.
Actually, I believe, and I don't want to start quoting here, that the timing is a little bit different than what you're quoting, but actually that is about what happened. Mm-hmm. There's an interview with a guy, I want to say his name is Frank Kurtz. And I'm going to look this up probably after this recording. If anyone really wants to know, you can email me, and I'll try and find the link to the actual interview, who's talking about kind of the creative path that both Star Wars and Indiana Jones, both being George Lucas things, went mm-hmm. down. And he talks about that. He talks about how George Lucas hit this kind of personal epiphany where he decided that he did not have to write good movies anymore.
Right.
That all he had to write was things that were a wild roller coaster ride that had big special effects and huge booms, and they'd go down as great movies. And he was not doing this in a P.T. Barnum way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this was not his way of hoodwinking society. This was an honest intellectual conclusion of his, that good movie making was flash and bang with no substance.
Right.
And that's what happened. You know, his movies went that direction. And I think the only thing that kept some of his early movies so good was he had people in there.
Yeah, he had investors and people saying, okay, we want to make a buck off this,
and you
George.
And you had people like Sir Alec Guinness. You had people like Harrison Ford that were in there rewriting their lines on the spot to improve the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been told a story, and I don't know if this is true or urban legend, that during Empire Strikes Back, which is generally regarded as the best of the Star Wars movies, that the director of the movie ejected him from the set. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I've been told this by someone who's really into movies and knows these kinds of stories.
So it must be true.
So, I don't know. But
it'd
the
be
point
interesting
is,
if it is, yeah.
You know, the point is, though, nonetheless, there are many stories about these kinds of things going on a set, that people were constantly correcting him and reeling him in. And I see that with myself. You know, I am an aspiring writer, and I have written some stuff that's gotten published. Most of the stuff is just still sitting there just because lately I've been too busy with the podcast and other things to pursue it.
Oh, but sure. It's our fault.
No, no, this goes back before even the podcast started. But,
you have too many hobbies.
I decided once just to see if I could do it, finish it, to write a full-length novel. Came out about 110,000 words. And when it was done, I mean, it went through a lot of edits. And I could sit down with it, and there were some times where my editors, the people I had looking at, would look at it, and I really think they had a better sense than I did where the story needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
They had a better sense than I did what the audience was getting sick of and what they wanted more of. And, you know, if I ever do make it as a writer, or even let's take something I'm already succeeding at as a podcaster, we're in sorry shape the day that we lose so much touch with the consumer that we just assume we've got it all figured out all the time. And I think that's what happened to BattleTech.
You know what? That reminds me of an interesting conversation I had. I was at a convention, and Jim Bain was doing a panel, and there were a couple other authors there. And I really don't remember who the authors were, but they were...
Rest in peace, Jim. He actually died
about
a month ago, yeah.
Oh, that sucks. He was such a cool guy.
Yeah.
What did Jim Bain write?
Jim Bain didn't write anything. Well, he might have wrote something, but he was Bain Publishing.
Yeah, he was
They do military sci-fi.
He owned, and he would think he was the general
editor.
Yeah,
go to a sci-fi section in a bookstore, and when you see the Bain symbol, look down across the bay at all the hundreds of Bain symbols. And anyway, what he was saying, I asked him a question, because they were having this sort of same conversation. I was like, as a writer, should a writer write what's in his heart, what the story that he wants to tell, or should a writer write what he thinks the fans want? Should he write to the fans? And Jim Bain was like, no, the writer should write what he wants. And he didn't say that as, oh, you know, a sort of a hippie thing. It's, oh, you got to write what's in your heart and all that. He's like, no, the fans can smell it a mile away.
Well, I think there's certainly a shade of gray here where, yes, you can also hit the point where you become, and this is really bad right now in music, a manufactured sensation.
Right.
And, I think editing
is different. You know, like what you were saying.
Right. And I think that's the difference.
Good editing is different.
I agree. Right from the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the truest, most honest, most powerful stories. But write them with humility.
Right.
Write them with the willingness to be told you were wrong about something and to go back and revisit it. And I think that's where the key is. And the problem with BattleTech was it lost touch.
Yeah.
And I was actually, my brother and I were fairly good friends at the time with Camille Klein. And if anyone's really into the BattleTech backstory, the things that went on outside of the game, you probably know who I'm talking about, who was the founder of the whole Church of BattleTech thing. It was kind of a tongue-in-cheek fan organization. And there was a whole bunch of us that had the ear of someone at FAS or AWOL who said to them, you guys are killing this game.
Mm-hmm.
And they would not hear it. She even actually went so far as went up to Chicago and had a day-long powwow, and she played a bunch of map battles and such against some of the higher ups there. And I don't remember if it was like Tom Dowd or Brian Neistel or Sam Lewis or who it was exactly, but had this big powwow with them and just kept trying to say to them, you know, you're killing this game. And they just would not hear it. They kept saying, well, yeah. we think we know what we're doing. We're taking this in the right direction and this, that, and the other. And I don't want to jump mm-hmm. so far to judge their character to say they lost their humility. Because I don't think that was the point there.
Yeah.
But I think they had just, they'd gotten so buried in the corporate machine of it, they lost touch. Right.
They lost touch with their fan base. And you know what? I think that, that's why a lot of modern role-playing games that are out right now are really, really good. That's why a lot of them are really popular, is because right now in the role-playing game industry, we live in the age of the indie games. Part of that is the D20 system, and part of that is just there's really not much competition from the big guys. So the little guys can come up, and the little guys are fans, and they listen to their fans, and they have a community, and they produce good products.
That's something that was getting kicked around for a while on there's a forum for the RPG podcasters, which mm-hmm. obviously being RPG podcasters, we're on there. And they were talking about the success of the indie game booths at Gen Con this year, just the unexpected smashing success. And they're trying to dissect why it is.
Sadly missed by our podcasters.
Yeah. Oh, don't remind me.
But, you know, as I was listening to them talk about this, it struck me there was an elephant in the room that no one was talking about, which is what you just said, which is the fact that the big names aren't what they used to be.
Right.
The fact that there are really, I mean, there may be good titles out there, but you do not have the market dominators you once had that were just the huge games everybody played.
Still, I mean, if you go into a Barnes & Noble, pretty much the only role-playing game they're going to stock is D&D.
Well, that's because, I mean, I like Barnes & Noble, but Barnes & Noble is a big corporation, and they have to be generalists.
At least if you go to a small store like mine.
Yeah, well, they have to be generalists.
D&D has a unique position. D&D is entrenched as the traditional game.
Right.
That when you say role-playing game to anyone on the street, especially a non-gamer, the first thing in their mind is Dungeons & Dragons.
Your mom
It's like marijuana. It's the door. It's the gateway game.
It's a gateway game. Wow.
But if you think about it, I mean, really.
Yeah, that was my first game.
I mean, really, with D&D... You know, you can think about these big market-dominating D&D products of days gone by, like the original Forgotten Realms box set.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not aware of anything like that for D&D. Yeah, I mean, sure, they've got updated editions and such.
Well, they have that kind of stuff, only it's for a niche market. Because they release the D20 system as, whatever open license it is. I forget what it is.
Yeah, OGL, Open Gaming License or something that.
Because they have that, they don't have the one dominated product that's pushed in marketing. They have, people have lots of little products. And that, so it fills niches. Instead of everybody has Forgotten Realms and everybody plays Forgotten Realms, you just have everybody playing all kinds of different stuff.
I think that also plays in kind
of
with it's kind of a new marketing trend. Yeah. You have like 100 different flavors for 100 different types of people, you know? It's like, so now you've got like, if you go to the candy aisle, you've got like 6 different kinds of M&Ms to choose from. It's like same thing with games.
Something else I think helps with the indie guys.
Why am I not surprised you did an M&M analogy?
I love M&Ms.
It'd be chocolate or ice cream. But one of the things that I think...
Oh, Ben & Jerry's.
One of the things that I think also helps... Or we have to go do an Oberweis run or something.
Best idea I've heard all night. Let's roll.
I could use a chocolate shake, but we'll...
And then we just leave the mic rolling. Just roll.
Silence. The garage door.
That was good.
What the hell are all these mics? Oh, damn it! This is why we're in podcasting, not radio.
We got 3 pets here. It's like, we come back and it's like, rough, rough. Meow, meow, meow.
Oh, it's too horrible to think about.
But one of the things I think also helps with the indie games, there's the old... sort of cliche that if you want to know what you should do for a living, imagine you're a multimillionaire billionaire trust fund baby and did not need to work, assuming you're not just a complete slug who's going to watch TV all day. What is it you would do with your time? And that's the thing you should find a way to do for a living. And I think because of the fact that there are people that enter this market, and I'll take the example of podcasting, podcasters like us who are doing this either with really no interest in making money at all, or they maybe want to make some money, but this is not their main job. They do this for the love of doing it. That first of all, they turn out a great product typically. And secondly, they are still so intimately in touch with the market as a whole because they're part of that market. Mm-hmm. And this is very different than someone who does this for a living, who ends up concealed inside of a corporate ivory tower, surrounded by charts and graphs and budgets and mission
Somebody
statements.
Works at Hasbro, maybe?
Yeah, exactly.
Never mind.
Someone who works at Hasbro, for example, and they lose sight of what they're doing. And I think that's one of the reasons that indie games are so successful right now, is because you get people that do it for the same reason we do this podcast, for the love of doing it, not because they're surrounded by charts and mission statements mm-hmm. and marketing teams.
And you know what? All those stuff, that's a great way to make money and have a corporation, but it's not necessarily the most creative path in the world. And that's ultimately what putting out a game product is. I mean, I think it's 50%. I'm not so pie in the sky here, but I know that it's 50% creativity, but 50% marketing. So, you know, I'm going to have to counter you with that, Dan. I do think that you need the corporation, the marketing, the mission statement, and all that.
You do
to
feel
successful. To push the product.
Well, I'll agree. But
not to create the product.
To have a successful product, I agree that you need that.
Yes.
But I don't think that necessarily is a good way to arrive at a good product.
Right.
And I think once you hit that point, you're in a very dangerous spot. If you got a corporation and marketing and all stuff, you've probably got a big product. You've probably got some commercial success. You've got something the fans like. Means you did something right somewhere along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, can you avoid becoming so insulated
right.
by that environment that you fail to keep it good? That suddenly you take one of the most interesting games I've ever seen and you turn it into Gloob toys that have spring-loaded heads.
Yeah.
So that, in a nutshell, is the tragic tale of Battletech mixed in with all kinds of random grandpa musings.
Yeah, back in my day, we played the Battletech. I hit you with this game. Roll for that.